Would you repeat that question that we were talking about just now?
Yes. Yes. The question has to do with changes you've seen during your career in the role of economists and the place of economists in our society.
Well, I just had a young man in my office a few minutes ago. He transferred to another school, and he wanted to know about one of the courses. I said, do you have a mathematics background? He says, in high school. I said, well, unless you have calculus, don't take the course. And he can't be an economics major unless he takes the course. He says, well, I don't like calculus. I said, well, then make up your mind. Either one, you can't take it, or you don't take the course. Mm-hmm. When I was a graduate student at Harvard, we had a professor who edited a volume. It was about 300 pages. He said to us, if you can understand this volume, you will know all the mathematics you need for graduate school. Well, today, if you know that volume, you'd be maybe pass a course. If you pick up an economics journal and you're not well trained in mathematics, you won't understand hardly anything. There's also a great demand for economists at high level planning, but you have to have advanced degrees. For instance, an economics major graduating here doesn't stand a chance one in 100 to get a job as an economist. If he has a master's degree, maybe one in 75. But it doesn't have enough background or training to do the kind of work. One thing, people have an impression that economists get into investing and that kind of stuff. Yeah. They're not. Because I get asked a question very often. I run all kinds of adult education courses. What about the stock market? Yeah. That's as close to economics as it is to ask when's the next satellite taking off. They're not very closely related at all. You don't talk about that in your courses, except uh-huh. you happen to have a special investing course. So in town here today, for example, there probably aren't five openings for economists in the whole city. And if there were, they'd be with banks or investment companies. The large corporations are not hiring because they'll bring in economic consultants. So economists, the ones from our department that graduated with PhD degrees, they'll go to teaching, they'll go to government organizations, they'll go to research concerns or to consulting companies. Mm-hmm. And then an awful lot of the economists done in town, for example, I consult with half a dozen different companies. All right, so they don't hire their own economists.
I see.
So there's an awful lot of economics are going on, but it's a very specialized type of training. There's an association that just started maybe 15 years ago called the National Association of Business Economists. At one time I knew almost everybody belonged to it. Now it's grown much more, and I don't know that many people in it, but their original mandate would not take you in unless you did business consulting work. Or unless you're a business economist, now they take it with a broader base.
Is it possible for you to put in layman's terms just what is the work of an economist?
Well, there are all kinds of specialized ones. We have one now, for example, he's leaving for a year to go work with the President's Council of Economic Advisors. He's an expert on foreign trade policy.
I see.
So he will be advising on what United States should do in terms of its foreign trade policy. And I can say ahead of time, he's a great believer in free trade and no protection. Mm-hmm. So if you see a trend, a bigger trend than you see now in the United States towards no protection, that's some of his influence. Mm-hmm. We have others who are very much concerned with the regional development of Pittsburgh. What can be done about that? We have others who are very much interested in the public finance policies. My area is more pricing, antitrust, mergers, mm-hmm. and what is called forensic economics. That's where you work with attorneys trying to determine the economic value of a life which has been killed, disabled, discriminated against, or this is not so much in terms of a life, but in case there's a divorce, how you divide up the estate.
lots of areas then in it.
Yeah, so it depends which area, especially very few of them will cover a whole range of things, but I'd say that probably 3/4 of my consulting now is with attorneys, and I would probably consult with 200 of them in Pittsburgh and the rest of the country.
And that's where the mathematics comes in.
No.
Or it doesn't?
No, that's some mathematics. That's not the intense mathematics. Most of the mathematics are building up simulated models so that you can go to a company and say, well, if this happens and this happens, this is what I think the result's going to be.
I see.
No, in terms of determining the economic value of somebody, you have to know things about statistics and correlations and regressions, but that's not that complicated. But you have to know what data to use. That's important.
Yes. Well,
for example, I was supposed to be in federal court today, but the case was continued because one of the witnesses had a heart attack. So can't tell when they'll be back in. One of the defendants, rather. And in this particular instance, you have to figure out what the value would have been for somebody who is permanently disabled.
Yes.
So you have to know trends in wages, trends in occupations.
Oh, a good question would be how you feel about this big squabble that's going on in this country about insurance rates, especially for doctors and...
Well, I think that most of that's brought on by the insurance companies themselves. First of all, most malpractice cases never even get started. They're dropped. And very few of them are won in court. But what happens in many cases, supposing here's a doctor who's insured for $100,000 because they have in Pennsylvania what's called the CAT fund, the catastrophic fund, which takes over. And the plaintiff says to him, look, we'll settle for your policy. Maybe he's got $100,000 and maybe the hospital's $100,000, so we'll settle for $200,000. Insurance company says, no way. So they try to negotiate, and they don't settle. Case finally goes to court, 3 years, what it takes about. In the meantime, you write him a letter called Good Faith. And you say, look, I'll settle for the policy limits, and they say no. And then in court, after about 3 years, verdict comes down for $1 million. The insurance company has to pay the $1 million even though the coverage is only $200,000 because they didn't settle in good faith. And then this is 3 years later, so there's a delay damage of 30%. So the verdict is $1.3 million. They could have settled for the $200,000. And then that's then the newspaper you see, Dr. XYZ, $1.3 million.
That's all we hear, yes.
You don't know the ins and outs where it got to. So most of them are very few dramatic cases. And then if you see the types of individuals on whom the malpractice was performed, here's somebody who goes into the hospital perfectly all right, except they need some kind of operation, and an anesthesiologist makes a mistake and they come out of it. So $1.3 million is going to help in any ways. The cost of institutionalized care be anywhere from $35,000 to $50,000 a year. If a person's gonna live for 40 years, that's $2 million. So I don't think that those rates are exorbitant.
So the insurance companies really are making a case for themselves.
They are. They don't expect them to do anything else.
Right, they're in business.
Now the other kind is, let's say you run a roller skating rink or an ice rink, there are liabilities. But if you run this properly, you won't have a liability suit. Liability suit is because something is wrong, and the other one is dram shop. If you go into one of these taverns here and you get drunk, you go out and you kill somebody, the bartender and the tavern owner are responsible.
Right.
And then they have the concept of joint and several liability, that maybe the bartender was only, the bar was only 1% liable, but it's got money. So all the damages go against the bar because the guy that hit you doesn't have anything.
Yeah.
So that raises the verdicts. But in most of these cases, the verdict in where you have permanent disability, death, and malpractice. Usually those, if you see the person, then it doesn't look so much. I sit on one case, but the verdict was $3.2 million. And the insurance for the lawyer for the defendant went over to the plaintiff's court for graduate, and after he did a very nice job, he got a nice big verdict. And this is a little girl, about 5 years old, who complete vegetable. And the mother said to the defendant, lawyer, look, I'll make you a deal. I'll give you back $3.2 million. You make my little girl whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the public doesn't see that. They see $3.2 million.
Well, the businessman feels it. The man going into business today who can't get insurance in some cases.
Well, depends
liability
what your insurance.
Yeah.
Is. Right. It depends what your business is.
Right.
If you're running an ordinary, let's say you're running a men's shop or a lady's shop, then your rates are not fantastic.
No, that's true.
But if you're running one where you potentially could create life, another way is to set up a bond. You don't need the insurance.
How do you do that?
Well, let's say you are bonded for $5 million. In the case of Pike, this was true in some workman's compensation. You don't have to take out workman's compensation, but you will, in effect, bond yourself for the difference so that the individual is not hurt.
You do that through an insurance company?
I don't know how you do it through. But I think it's possible.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
I have liability insurance here at Pitt, and they pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder, how can a teacher get into liability insurance?
Right.
Well, let's suppose I fail a student, and he comes along and says, this failure prevented me from getting into medical school, and you failed me discriminatorily. So I'm going to sue you.
So you're protected?
Up to a certain extent.
Yes.
Then on top of that, I have an umbrella policy which you pick up.
Yeah. And I have to call on you again.
I think maybe it would be interesting to have you talk about your own career. What has been most satisfying? What you look back on as high points? What kinds of things you would change if you had the opportunity?
I know it changed very much. I might have stayed in the Army. I was going to stay in it anyways. And enjoyed very much my active duty service, and then I stayed in the reserves for 26 years afterwards, and each year would go to summer Army camp plus additional days during the course of the year, and I was active with the Department of Defense. It was supposed to be called back in Vietnam, but just missed that. And very often, missed the fact that I would have had, I figure, a rather interesting career in the military.
What in the military, you say you did meet General Marshall, is that correct?
Yeah.
And you did comment on him, I remember. Were there any other great personalities you could remember that you'd like to say a few words about?
I never quite met, but I almost met General Patton. I was on maneuvers one time. We had a little break, about 2 hours, went to a post exchange just to get a soft drink.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we're told, get out, get out, get out. I wonder why everybody had suddenly get out. We just got in, because General Patton was coming into the post exchange. I suppose they were about to see him. But he didn't want to see anybody. He was supposed to be on duty doing something else.
Uh-huh.
He was there. And then through our offices came a lot of the top generals of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this special opportunity to meet them, because as an adjutant at that time, they would come through my office and I set up the appointment with the other generals.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to comment on other people in your life who have had a great effect on you in one way or the other, really significant.
Well, aside from family people, a lot of them were teachers. I used to have a lot of side arguments with the late Rabbi Ashinsky, because my father used to go to his shul every Saturday. I'd pick him up. It's got dark Saturday evening.
Excuse me, Rabbi Shinsky.
He was Orthodox, right?
Extremely Orthodox. Extremely. He ran the Chofetz Chaim on Beacon right next to Beacon Pharmacy.
Oh. Right.
And he would give these addresses Saturday afternoon in Yiddish for about an hour and a half. We'd have a lot of philosophy discussions with him. My wife's father and I were more like two individuals rather than a father-in-law, son-in-law. We'd go to ball games together. He didn't drive, I'd drive around occasionally. And it was a first-name basis. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, my wife was kind of shocked one time when I brought her to our house. By that time, my father had died, and my mother was living there. She used to sit upstairs, and we had a room where she'd sit and sew and read. And I called out her first name, and my wife says, well, who's, she wasn't my wife, but she was a girlfriend. She says, who are you calling? I thought you didn't have any more sisters at home. Well, so it was a big influence on my mother and father. And I used to have a deal with my father that every evening we studied a portion of the Chumash and Tanakh, because he was very well learned.
Then you read Hebrew.
Yep.
You speak Hebrew. No, no. Just read.
I speak a few words. But I can read it and I know what I'm reading.
Well,
I can occasionally at Tree of Life I'll conduct services at some in the morning or an evening.
Yeah, I thought I'd ask you, since you're familiar with Orthodox rabbis, how you feel about this rabbi in Israel. Do you remember his name? He's for eliminating the Arabs from Israel.
I think you mean Kahani.
Kahani.
Did you
ever meet him?
I think anybody that uses violent techniques, he's a lot to be desired. So I don't have much use for him, and I don't have much use for the rabbis who also say that unless you believe in extreme orthodoxy in Israel, you don't count. For example, if Rabbi Burke and the Tree of Life were to convert a young lady here, and she got married and went to Israel, she's not considered Jewish.
Not considered Jewish.
No, they don't accept that.
Yes.
And if you were a Reformed rabbi and you die in Israel, you can only be buried, I think, on the edge of a cemetery.
Wow.
Are you concerned about Israel's economic situation in the world?
Very much so. No nation can devote the percentage of their gross national product to national defense that they do and begin to prosper. And you find a very interesting thing taking place in Israel. They're not getting an influx of people anymore, and they're getting an outflux. The population base is going to shrink.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that can, in the long run, save Israel, and I became rather unpopular here some years ago when the late Rabbi Philip Sigal was here in town. He was a Hillel rabbi, and he also was kind of a rabbi in residence of the Tree of Life. He ran a series, and I talked and said the only thing that will save Israel is an Arab common market, including Israel, where you get together like you have a European common market. Because they cannot keep on living on U.S. charitable contributions.
Plus, how do you feel about the Arabs who are multiplying at a higher rate than the Israelis are?
One time they'll decide to go over. And increasingly so, they're getting more sophisticated weapons. The refusal of the United States to sell them weapons isn't going to help. They get them someplace else. It's going to be France.
That's true. So, how does it look?
Well, it's not a very promising outlook unless you have some cooperation. You're better off to have a common market than none at all.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the Arab people and Israeli people are very different than the people who rule And I've had Arab students. I have one of mine who's right now high up in the petroleum industry. He says that when he was a youngster, they dealt with Israel people. And there's no animosity to amount to much person to person. It's governments, and it's also, to a large extent, American Jewry. It's more anti-Arab than are your Israelis. It's a rallying point in the United States.
Yeah.
See, if you buy Israel bonds, you can be honored. You were honored. My wife and I were honored by Israel bonds.
Mm-hmm.
You get honored. It's a rallying point. You take away that rallying point, and you get back to cohesion in the United States. Israelis look at it very differently because they know what's costing them.
But they're not. Do you think they're leaving Israel because they don't see a future there? That
they don't see an economic future. Work real hard.
They can't get anywhere.
They don't come to the United States as much as they come to Southern Europe. Now, for example, at the military camps that I used to go to, we had all kinds of foreign military officers. Very, very rarely Israeli.
Mm.
From all over the Arab states, all over. The Israelis went to France.
Wonder why?
They just didn't come to the United States.
There's a great influx of them in San Francisco, Israelis, I happen to know, who all go into business and make lots of money there.
Well, they're bright people, ambitious people.
Very good in business. We're getting down to the end. We have room for one more question. Anne?
Summation. Your hopes for the future.
Good.
Your hopes for your family, for your jewelry, for Pittsburgh.
Well, now one of the most significant ones is my daughter's getting married.
Mazel tov.
That's a good hope, yes.
I would like to see greater cooperation among the Pittsburgh Jewry in actual cooperation rather than just saying things. Take, for example, the schools system. It's a very, very touchy system right now. One synagogue after another is giving up its Hebrew schools. Can't make them go. Fortunately, Tree of Life is growing one because we have expanded to some of the suburbs via satellites. Some of the others have problems. And if you take your children, you educate them at Hebrew Institute or someplace else, you divorce them from the synagogue. Out of the Shurin, I don't think, runs the school anymore. And Israel is getting very, very low on its school enrollments. And I think that the school system is necessary to be done at a synagogue so that you can introduce youngsters when they're small to synagogue. Take, for example, my daughter. She went to Hebrew school, Sunday school, Tree of Life. She was written up in Rotary Review when she had her bat mitzvah. So she joined Tree of Life after she was 21, already she and her potential husband have joined. Now, if she were trained, say, at Hebrew Institute, she'd have no contact with the synagogue. So I think that's one of the areas that they're missing completely. I think a federation should take a very, very strong stance, and instead of giving the money to outside organizations to teach, give them to the schools. They do make a small grant now, but it's not for teaching purposes. And I think there ought to be more cooperation in joint services. For example, we have a Friday night service, very few of the other shuls do, so you have to get more people to come over just to see the Friday night service. Our Saturday morning service is a different kind. There ought to be more people go there on Saturday service, get interchange, instead of being competitive. Because the only time the Jews tend to cooperate is whenever there's a central enemy and they cooperate. That suddenly changed a lot of attitudes in Pittsburgh in the 1930s when Germany became a central enemy. The State of Israel was formed, became a central rallying ground. Bonds for Israel becomes a central rallying ground.
Right.
Hopes for the city?
Well, it's going to be a much smaller city with a very, very different structure. It's not going to be the place where the relatively untrained manual labor find jobs, but relatively untrained service type workers will. Bigger emphasis on trade schools.
Hope for economy in our country. What kinds of hopes do you have as an economist?
It keeps on going into and out of cycles. I don't see any depression, real depression. I see a recession. I make a forecast each year in January, and my forecast made in January of 1986 said the last part of 86 will be a very unhappy time period. It's recessionary tendencies, and I still believe so.
We could go a step further, can we, and say it'll affect the stock market?
No connection between the two.
No?
I predicted the stock market would hit 1900 during 1986 and then recede, and it hit 1900 and went down. That was done in January of 86.
Good. Well, that's hopeful news.
You don't see any threat of the kind of devastating depression that we experienced in this country.
Not the kind of 1929-33, yeah.
Yeah, about that much. Would you like to make a final statement after this great interview?
Well, I was pleased and honored that Marlene asked me whether I would be willing to have people talk with me.
Good.
I think it's a good idea that you're doing. And I think people 20 years, 50 years from now will be faced with the same problems. I'm a great believer in historical approaches, and what I used to do in a course when I taught history of economic thought was take about 10 sentences from 10 very, very early writers, people who wrote in the 1800s, and give them to the students as a final exam and say, tell me who wrote or might have written this passage. And most of the time they'll pick some current economist.
It's that current. How about that? Well, that's a beautiful summation. And I'm glad we had this interview. How about
yes.
you?
Yes, we thank you so much.
You're
it's
welcome.
Been very informative and very helpful. And I think some future student listening to it will find much to think about.
Right.
So we do appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.